Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
Welcome to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here as we are here every day at this time, Monday through Friday on Breadbox Media to talk about life, the universe, and everything from a Catholic perspective. And it being Friday, we're here with none other than Steve Gradonis. Steve is the owner and proprietor of DecentFilms.com. He is a film critic who writes for the National Catholic Register, for Crux. Sometimes you'll see him in Catholic Digest, a busy bee who also makes the Real Faith videos in which we all hold our breath and hope that he can actually really get the review done in 60 seconds as is promised. Sometimes he goes over. But the first time through every review, you're mostly just you're watching the clock thinking, can he do it? Can he do it in 60 seconds? He did it. And then you go back and watch the review again to find out what he said because you were too busy watching the clock the first time.
It takes practice.
It takes some practice.
You know? It takes some practice. Can you believe that they only gave me 30 seconds in the old days?
Really?
I had to push for 60 seconds. 60 seconds was a big deception at first because they wanted me to do it in 30. There is not a lot you can say in 30 seconds when you have an intro and outro, let me tell you.
This movie does not suck. Okay, we're out of time. So, yeah. I want to see that, 2.5 stars. One enthusiastic thumbs up. This film did not suck. I want to see that review. Yeah. So, it's like, I always think of the reviews. There was this commercial that was done like a couple of years ago for some credit card with Jerry Seinfeld and Superman.
Right. I remember.
And they're looking over the reviews, and the review it's for some musical called Oh Yes, Wyoming. and the review is it's just one song after another. I've never forgotten that. I've always wanted to see somebody actually review a musical and use that line because it's just so great.
Well, but, a surprising amount of good criticism actually is more observational than it is probative or detracting.
Okay.
Being a good critic is more about seeing the movie or the book or whatever it is as it is, seeing what makes it different or the same as other things, and commenting about it in such a way as to give the reader or the viewer a larger perspective on it. And then, you know, you bring into that and I hated this and I loved that, or this is terrible or this is wonderful. Mm-hmm. But it's really much less about the thumbs up or the thumbs down and much more about what kind of a movie is this?
Steve, I'm sorry, but we're out of time. Sorry. I just couldn't resist. It just popped out.
That's fine. But I get that on Greg Popcheck's show all the time.
What, the we're out of time?
Yes. Yep. Okay. So you just started talking.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, this is where the Irish in me comes out, and I look at that... I look at that 60-second thing and I think, I'm just clearing my throat, you know, by the time 60 seconds has passed. So anyway, what's doing in the world of films, art, and more culture than a Petri dish these days?
Well, right now, this weekend, we have two Jesus movies in theaters, two Jesus movies at the same time, Jesus on screens in two entirely different films. That's not including the Coen brothers. Hail Caesar, where an actor plays the back of Jesus's head. I should say the back of an actor's head plays the back of an actor's head playing the back of Jesus' head, because it's a movie in a movie. Uh-huh. And George Clooney plays an actor who's playing a Roman soldier. But in both of these movies, The Young Messiah, which is in theaters now, you have Sean Bean playing a Roman soldier, a Roman tribune, who is on the trail of the Messiah and the Holy Family, and he's been commissioned by Herod Antipas to kind of finish the job that his father, Herod the Great, started in Bethlehem. And then in Risen, you have Joseph Fiennes at the other end of the Jesus story. Jesus has just been crucified, and he's now trying to track down the body and prove that he's really dead. So it's a very interesting time for Christians at the movies.
Yeah. Well, and Father Barron gave a pretty, or Father Barron, I still do that. Bishop Barron gave a pretty good, he gave an interesting review to Risen. And simply noting that one of the things that Risen does is it reaffirms, how should you put it, the facticity, I guess, of the resurrection. That the resurrection wasn't this thing that happened within the psyches of the apostles or some kind of visionary experience where if you had walked into the room where the apostles were seeing the risen Christ, you wouldn't have seen anything. And he says, you know, people walk into the room in Risen. You know, some unbelieving Roman soldier walks into the room and sees the risen Christ because he's actually risen. He's not just some kind of vision, which is what the Gospels are at pains to say over and over and over again.
The Spirit Gospels, has not flesh and bones, as you see that I have.
The Spirit does not have flesh and bones, and nor does a vision experience have flesh and bones, as you see that I have. So give me some fish. And when they hand him the fish, there's less fish on the plate afterwards, you know, because Jesus is actually there and eating it. And so, you know, over and over again, you have Jesus say, you know, here, stick your finger in my side. Here, touch my hands. And the Gospels are at pains to emphasize this. The first letter of John is at pains to emphasize this, that which we have seen, which we have handled with our hands. And so what the Gospels are saying is anyone present, believer or not, would have seen the risen Christ because he was standing there throwing a shadow, making a noise when he tramped the floorboards and eating fish. And I appreciated that and what Father Barron had to say about that. So anyway, but we were talking about The Young Messiah.
The Young Messiah, which is opening this weekend. And so far, Thursday box office looks really good. I may be the only critic in America who thinks that The Young Messiah is not just better than Risen, but a lot better than Risen. Most critics are contrasting it unfavorably. They're saying Risen was really better, and The Young Messiah, it lacks imagination. It doesn't really do anything interesting with the story. And I don't know. I've seen it twice now. I've had a completely different experience. I am really excited about The Young Messiah. It pushes a lot of buttons for me. Theology buttons, scripture and canon buttons, parent buttons. You know, it's a story really about the Holy Family at a privileged point in its existence, where you're not dealing anymore with the challenges around Mary's surprise pregnancy and is Joseph going to believe her and all of that. Now Joseph and Mary are together. They're on the same page. They're trying to bring up Jesus, but they're still dealing with this awesome responsibility that God has given them. And they have to ask a lot of the same questions that any parent asks, which is, you know, how much can, you know, what do we tell our son about these very difficult subjects, you know, and at what point? And so there's a lot of interesting stuff going on.
Cool. So this, by the way, relates to another piece that you've written that I thought was rather cleverly titled, What Did Jesus Know and When Did He Know It?
Yes.
And it is, you know, part of the difficulty of discussing any of this is that the Gospels themselves are notoriously resistant to psychological analyses of Jesus. What they're doing is they're simply presenting us who Jesus is. So we don't get anything really of what's going on in Jesus's mind. We see his actions sometimes. So we know from his actions, for example, in the Garden of Gethsemane, that he's terrified of what's about to happen to him.
And not just terrified, but he's entertaining the possibility that maybe there's another option.
Maybe there's some way out. Yeah.
Maybe there's some way out.
And so you'll see, you know, you'll see his what's going on in his mind and heart through his actions. But you don't get it's very rare in antiquity to get psychological analyses kinds of stories, and especially in biblical literature.
Biblical literature is among the most non-descriptive literature in the ancient world. You look at the epics of the Greeks and the Romans, and you get lots of descriptive detail and memorable incidents. The Gospels, and Robert Alter, who has written a lot about the Bible as literature, the art of biblical literature, has really emphasized the non-descriptive nature of biblical literature. It either isn't interested in the imagination, or it's going to leave a lot to the imagination of the reader.
Right. Right. And for that, that's why you get another phenomenon that arises in Jewish writing called the Midrash.
Exactly.
Where people try to fill in these broad outlines that you're given, the sort of, you know, black and white coloring book outline sketches of biblical figures and events. And then somebody else comes along later and says, well, tell me more. Well, let's dress this up with, you know, a bunch of other detail and stuff. And that's what Midrash is.
Right. And they do. They bring in all that kind of stuff.
Right. And so, you know, then you get to hear, you know, the interior thoughts of people and this sort of thing. But biblical literature, New Testament literature, especially in its portrayal of Jesus, it's just not there. We will continue this discussion when we return. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here on Breadbox Media today with none other than Stephen Bredonis. And we will be back right after this.
Breadbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.
With none other than Stephen Bredonis. We were talking a bit about Young Messiah. Talking about, before the break, just discussing this, there's no biblical data that we've got. We can surmise certain things from what we know of the Holy Family. We can surmise certain things from what we but mostly what you've got to sort of cover that whole span. One little vignette from when he's 12, and this is a story that's actually younger than that, is he grew in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and man. And that's kind of it. That's what we're told. Which it, in fact, is. So talk about that a little bit.
So the Young Messiah is directly based on a novel called Christ the Lord Out of Egypt. It's written by Anne Rice. And she wrote it on her return to the Catholic faith of her youth. She had gone through a sojourn into atheism and so forth. She came back to her Catholic faith in 1989. She's since become alienated from the church again, although she continues to strongly identify with Jesus in some sense. But the novel reflects her attempts to grapple with the humanity of Christ and to answer a lot of the skeptical scholarship that has been written around Jesus. And so she draws on the New Testament, on the Gospels, and also on some of those kinds of imaginative approaches to Jesus' early life and so forth that we were talking about before the break, to the infancy Gospels of Thomas and James. James is a source that Catholics use for such details as the names of the parents of Joseph and Mary and so forth. The infancy Gospel of Thomas is really not a good source for anything. It's except what certain people were thinking about in the ancient world. It's got a picture of Jesus that we can't really square with the Jesus that we know at all. But Rice tries to use some of it and then reconcile it with biblical imagination. And the writers and the director of the film, Cyrus Narasta, and his wife Betsy, who is a Christian, and Cyrus is much more now a Christian now than he was before, they have gone even further in taking these details and really bringing them in line with the world of biblical imagination and the kinds of things that Jesus really did. Let me give you one example right from the beginning. So very famously in the infancy Gospel of Thomas, 5-year-old Jesus, some boy bumps into him and Jesus curses him and he dies. You know, he's more like the boy in that Twilight Zone episode, It's a Good Life, where he puts everything in the cornfield. And then he also makes these birds out of clay and he brings them to life, which again is not something we can really see Jesus doing. Well, in the movie, a boy does... A boy is attacking Jesus, and a moment later, he falls down and he hits his head and he dies. And people accuse Jesus of having cursed him because they know that Jesus is, there's something a little odd about him. But in fact, it's the devil that has caused the boy to die. And then Jesus does what you would expect Jesus to do in a situation like that. And similarly, the bird that he brings to life is not a clay bird. It was just a dead bird. When he was younger, he brought a dead bird back to life, which, you know, so it's more in the world of biblical imagination. Whether you don't have to think these things actually happened, but I like the way of reimagining these stories and reinterpreting them in the light of the sensibilities of Scripture. And that's part of the kind of thing that I'm so enthusiastic about in this film.
Okay. That's cool. Yeah, and it's, you know, these are, how should I put it? There are people who are very fearful about these kinds of attempts to kind of fill in the gospel. But, you know, this is a story that's being told, I think, reverently. This is not, you know, the last temptation of Christ or something like this, where we're getting fairly severe attacks on the faith coming forward. These are things that are legitimate works, I think, of Christian imagination. Attempting to try to grapple with those questions that you do have. So, you know, in your article, what did Jesus know and when did he know it? That's a question that I think is probably, you know, millions of Christians have at some point or another asked themselves, how would, you know, the infinite omniscience of God live out his life as a human being with, you know, with a brain made out of meat like the rest of us, having to learn things. We're told that he lived a fully human life. Well, being a fully human life involves, among other things, growth from childish knowledge to adult knowledge.
Right.
How's that lived? You know, what does that look like? And because the New Testament, as we were talking about before the break, because the New Testament isn't interested in psychology and doesn't try to do psychological analyses of its subject, we simply are not told anything about that. So it's something where Christian imagination can, I think, legitimately go to work and play around with that. What does deity look like in the mind and heart of a child?
And there are really, basically, there are two fundamental extremes to avoid. And within those extremes, I think we have to allow to imagination a considerable leeway to explore and to picture possibilities, even if those possibilities aren't exactly what you know, some theologians tell us really happened. You know, if you look at the Sistine Chapel ceiling, you're not going to see a literal depiction of anything. You know, God creating the world did not look like that. And God creating Adam and Eve did not. So we have here an imaginative interpretation. And what the two extremes that we have to try to avoid are, on the one hand, you have to try to avoid Nestorianism. So Nestorianism is going to separate the humanity of Jesus and the divinity of Jesus into two essentially hermetically sealed chambers, so that Jesus is, there's the God, and that there's the Lord God, the second person of the Blessed Trinity, and then there's the human Christ. And somehow there's a connection between them, but it's, you know, basically Jesus is human, and that's the Nestorian error. Whether Nestorius actually believed it is beside the point. That's in heresiology, we call that Nestorianism. But then, on the other hand, we have something that we're a little less familiar with, and that's Apollinarianism. And the Catechism talks about this in Numbers 440 through 444. And Apollinarianism is the error of imagining Jesus as like a human body with, instead of a rational soul, the second person of the Blessed Trinity kind of plugged in there. Right. So this, you have this body walking around and eating and walking and talking, but inside what's animating it is not a human soul, a human mind, a human intellect, but the second person of the Trinity. And that's wrong too.
Right.
So when Jesus empties himself and takes the form of a slave, he acquires a truly human knowledge that has to grow and learn. And there are things that the Catechism tells us he doesn't know in this form. Now, he's also says that he hasn't been sent to reveal those things, but and there's knowledge that he has to acquire for himself, which you can only acquire by experience. And how you balance that line between those two errors is the question.
Yeah, our faith commits us dogmatically to the proposition that Jesus had to be potty trained. That's a crude way of putting it, but it really is the case that the second person of the Trinity incarnate needed to learn all the stuff that we need to learn as human beings. He had to go through all the developmental stages. People hear that, that's not reverent. That is absolutely orthodox. The Word became flesh. Jesus had a human mind and a human soul. It is with a human heart that he loved. It's Luther who says that, you know, Mary made soup for God. You know, Mary taught him his alphabet. And, Jesus was homeschooled, among other things, as was everybody at that time. These are good things. This is the great mistake that Nestorius made, of course. Nestorius thought that it was debasing and degrading to say that the Word really became flesh, and he was always looking for a way out of that. This was the great shock for many, many early Christian heretics, was to try to figure out some way to say that that the Word didn't really become flesh. That's what Apollinarianism is trying to do as well. In this case, trying to get rid of Jesus's soul and replace it with deity. That insistence of the tradition that Jesus is fully God and fully man, I think is theologically, that is the single most scandalous thing that the church has to assert, and people still are uncomfortable with it. We will be back right after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We will be back with Steve Gradonis right after this.
Bread Soapbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.
To Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we're here today with Steve Gradonis. By the way, if you want to join the conversation, please give us a call. We're at 1-573-4-BREAD-4, 1-573-4-BREAD-4. You can join the conversation. You can also tweet us at Breadbox Media, or you can text us at the number 1-573-4-BREAD-4 as well. We've been talking a little bit over the last... the last segment, we're talking about Young Messiah, the new. I'm sorry. When I hear Young Messiah, all I can think of is it's one of those choir things where we're all going to sing Handel, and you know, the Messiah sing along. Every time I hear Young Messiah, that's what it makes me think of. But talking about that, and talking about the complexity of trying to deal with the psychology of Jesus, and particularly the developmental psychology of Jesus, trying to portray that. What does that look like? Because the New Testament doesn't fill in any of that. But Young Messiah is grappling with those kinds of questions. What does Jesus know? When does he know it? How does a child process the knowledge that he is... Yes, I'm Joseph and Mary's son, and growing up here in this time and place, and I am also the eternal Word of God.
and there are really those two extremes to avoid. Where on the one hand we picture Jesus being just like anybody else, and right. Making the same mistakes as everyone, and not being different or special in any way, and then on the other hand, where you imagine Jesus as like one of the stars of Baby Geniuses, where every time when he's like 2 years old, he's speaking in complete sentences, and he knows all mysteries and all knowledge, and even Thomas Aquinas talks about Jesus acquiring knowledge in a human way. And St. Thomas doesn't even like to think about anybody teaching Jesus. To him, that goes against Jesus' dignity as the teacher. So in his mind, Jesus wouldn't seek instruction from anyone until he'd already acquired that human knowledge for himself. So that's an interesting theory. It's mm-hmm. one interpretation. It's not one that's particularly persuasive to me.
Right.
What the movie does is it has a Jesus who knows that he's special, who knows that he can do these things. He can bring the dead back to life. He knows when people are praying. He can heal the sick. He doesn't know why he can do these things. Joseph and Mary haven't told him for the excellent reason. It's the same reason that Jesus doesn't go around telling people that he's the Messiah in his ministry. It's because it's dangerous. Hmm. And, at 7 years old, sometimes you're liable to open your mouth and say things that may not be the most prudent thing to say at the time, mm-hmm. even if you're the Son of God, because you don't necessarily at that age with that level of emotional maturity. So this interpretation goes, you don't necessarily know all the consequences.
Right.
There are soldiers, Roman soldiers, who are looking for a baby from Bethlehem who might have escaped the slaughter of the innocents. And at one point, somebody brings up Bethlehem, and Jesus just says brightly, "I was born in Bethlehem." And his parents are like,
"Shut up, quiet."
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So he doesn't know. And when Jesus asks him, "Why won't you tell me?" Joseph says he says, "Like many a father has, your questions are the questions of a boy, but the answers are the answers for a man." Hmm. And Jesus had to go from being a boy to a man. Now, is this the only way to imagine this, or do we have to imagine it this way? No. But right. This is one serious attempt to grapple with the question of Jesus' knowledge. And for the most part, I found it fascinating and compelling. And I would say that it's added to my total picture of what the incarnation was like, built up from the books that I've read and the movies that I've seen in various other sources. This is one thing that's given me a new perspective, and it's one that I really appreciate.
Okay. Very good. Yeah. Well, I'm looking forward to that one. You know, the Risen story is a story, of course, we all know. But this is a story that it's a new speculation. Of course, that's what it is it speculation. But I'm interested to see it. But then again, I always trust your judgment. So what else is going on out there?
Well, I wrote a piece today about a subject that I've been thinking about for a while. It wasn't necessarily something I was going to write about right this minute, but I got some bad news this week, and I don't know if you've had a chance to see it. So I'm going to mention it now. I have been writing for the past 18 months a weekly column for Crux, and it's been a great thing for me. I've been forced every single week to sit down opposite a blank sheet of paper and come up with something to put on it. And that discipline and also the freedom of having taken a little bit of a step outside of the Catholic bubble, that's been good for me. But this is coming to an end. Crux is parting ways with the Boston Globe, and so they are the Globe was just going to shutter the operation. John Allen asked for permission to try to perpetuate it, look for donors, keep the thing going, but it's not going to be as it was. And the freelancers are so my time at Crux is done.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I am very grateful for it. Like I said, it's been a great thing for me in many ways. And I feel like it's really helped me to grow as a writer. One of the things I've been thinking about doing, because I'm a big animation fan, is I wanted to write about pro-life themes in animation, about the cultures of life and death in animation. And I thought of doing this because I saw that there was a new DVD edition of Horton Hears a Who that I didn't think was notable enough to write about, but it made me think of writing the piece. Because, of course, Horton Hears a Who and Horton himself have long been claimed by the pro-life movement for their own. And it's obvious to see why.
Oh, sure. A person's a person, no matter how small.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And in this case, the persons that Horton is protecting are microscopic. They exist on a little speck of dust, the head of a pin. And the other animals see this speck of dust and they say, that's not life. There's no life there. And they want to destroy it. But Horton is determined to protect it at all costs. And I find it interesting that the leader of the animals, who is leading this attack against Horton, is a sour kangaroo, a mother figure, who has this baby kangaroo in the pouch as the story progresses. And this is not the first time that Horton has been opposed by a mother figure. His first adventure was not Horton Hears a Who, but Horton Hatches the Egg, in which Horton winds up babysitting an egg after its irresponsible mother, a bird named Maisie, takes off. And so this mother abandons her child, and Horton is left to care for this embryonic life. So in both cases, there is a mother figure who is not being what we think a mother figure should be. And there is an embryonic or a microscopic life that is endangered unless Horton steps up. And I find those parallels between those two stories and the way that they play out in the 2008 computer animated Horton Hears a Who by Blue Sky Studios, starring Jim Caviezel as Horton and Steve Carell as the mayor of Whoville.
Jim Caviezel?
Sorry. Jim Carrey.
Jim Carrey. Okay.
Jim Carrey.
That's a big step.
Yes. Jim Carrey doing penance for having messed up another.
Having committed the Grinch Who Stole Christmas. Yes.
But here he really redeems himself because his portrayal of Horton is he really tones down all of his Carreyisms and he creates a character who is still much more whimsical than the Dr. Seuss figure, but is credibly he has Horton's heart, and I like that cartoon.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I'm thinking about what are other animated films that I can think of that have pro-life themes in them. A lot of them because they're family oriented, they tend to be, you know, they're going to have, you know, films that affirm, you know, the love of family and the love of life, the goodness of life. I can also think, of course, I mean, when you get to things like, you know, adaptations of, you know, Frank Miller novels and stuff, you can also run across, you know, real culture of death stuff too. But
yes, absolutely.
Because of the nature of animation and because of the audience that's traditionally associated with it, you can find a lot of stuff that's very affirming of the family, you know, or stories of redemption, or you know, and a lot of it goes under the radar because it's animated, and you know, after your kids are a certain age, you don't wind up going to animated films as much, you know, because you've got a limited movie budget, you're not going to be spending it on, you know, Atlantis, you know, or you know, or something like that. But do you have other films that you've got in mind?
There are, and I think we've got a break coming up, so we're going to have to talk about it after the break. But okay. In a nutshell, some of the other movies that occurred to me in this connection are Up. By Pixar, the Pixar film Up, which, well, there's the music.
Wonderful. Well, yeah, we'll talk about Up when we come back. I love that movie so much. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we will be back with Stephen Gradonis right after this.
Redbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
And welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we're here today with Stephen Gradonis. Been all over the map today. We've been talking about the Young Messiah and the consciousness of Jesus, and talking about culture of life and death in animated films. And gee whiz, we've just been everywhere. And I am stunned to realize as I look at my calendar on the clubhouse wall that Easter is it's two Sundays away from this Sunday. This is Lazarus Sunday coming up, and then next Sunday is Palm Sunday, and then bam, it's Easter already. We just got here. I'm gobsmacked. So before we went to the break, we were talking briefly about other culture of life, culture of death, animated films.
Right. We started out talking about Horton Hears a Who, because obviously a person's a person, no matter how small. And Steve Carell, comedy, Blue Sky Studios, computer animated adaptation is really very nice. And in addition to capturing Horton's defense of this embryonic life, this microscopic life on this speck of dust, it includes other elements as well. I mentioned how the main antagonist is this sour kangaroo. In this version of the story, her offspring, her Joey, actually winds up at the very end, switching sides. He hears the voice of the Who's, and so he comes over to Horton's side, and so you have the baby on the side of life against the mother, and I think that's interesting. And then down in Whoville, we have Steve Carell playing the mayor of Whoville, and his name is Ned McDodd, and his wife's name is Sally, and they have 97 children, 96 girls, and then one boy, who of course is the one who saves the day in the end. But I just thought, your name is McDodd and you have 97 children, You're Catholic.
So true. So it's like the, you know, it's like the Weasleys in the Harry Potter series. Like the Weasleys are painfully obviously they are the Irish Catholic family of the Wizarding World. In they're all redheads, you know. But anyway, go ahead.
So then you have a couple of films worth talking about from Pixar. Pixar's Finding Nemo and Pete Docter's Up, both of which express the value of unborn life in or embryonic life in their prologues, in the very beginning of the film. So tragedy strikes Marlin and Coral in the first act of Finding Nemo, and Coral is killed trying to save her clutch of eggs. There are like 1,000 of them, and nearly all of them are destroyed, but one is spared. And you get this shot where Marlin, having lost his wife and nearly all of his children, he has this one egg left, and he just comes and he cradles it in his fins, this tiny little fish egg. And you can see through the translucent membrane, you can see the little wiggling fry that is going to become Nemo.
Right.
And this image of which you get a first person shot. I think it's the only first person shot from Marlin's point of view in the film, where he's cradling this egg and the preciousness of it. Right. And there's a flashback to it later on, and you realize how this moment is really seared on his mind. And that's Finding Nemo. Then you get a very different but related picture in Pixar's Up, in which we get this wonderful silent ode to the whole marriage of Ellie and Carl from the time of their wedding to the time when he's widowed. And it's just, it's devastating. But in the middle of it, there's this amazing sequence where they're sitting on the grass, looking up at clouds, talking about what they look like. And Ellie breaks the news to Carl that she's pregnant. And we know this because suddenly all the clouds look like babies to him.
Yeah.
And then we get this shot of the two of them decorating a nursery to receive the baby. Ellie is painting a picture of a stork carrying a bundle of joy on the wall. But then the camera does this dolly track, this movement to the side, and we find ourselves in an OBGYN's office, and Ellie is weeping as the doctor breaks the bad news to her. And then we see her at home, and she just has this very agonized expression on her face. And you realize that not only did they lose the baby, but they're not going to be able to try again.
Yeah.
And to tackle that kind of subject matter in a computer animated Hollywood film, a Disney distributed film, I find that amazing. And I don't think it's a coincidence that Pete Docter, the director of Up, and Andrew Stanton, the director of Finding Nemo, are among the openly Christian filmmakers at Pixar.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah. And that, you know, I mean, I saw something on, you know, Facebook one time remarking that, you know, Up told a more profoundly moving love story in 5 minutes than the Twilight series has done in 4 films, you know. And
it's so true.
Yeah, it was just it was amazing what they achieved. And that was just prologue to the main story. Yeah. I mean, you know,
and Hornaday said that it was worthy of Chaplin.
Yeah, it was it was a magnificent piece of work.
The fact that they do it without dialogue is just it's part of the achievement.
Yeah.
So then there are a couple of films in what you might call the three men and a baby genre. And they are Pixar's Monsters Incorporated, which is also by Pete Docter, the director of Up, and Ice Age, the 2002 Ice Age, which was the debut film for Blue Sky Studios. And in these films, you have an unlikely number of protagonists, male protagonists, very non-parental figures who are saddled much against their will with a baby in one and a toddler in the other. And at first, they are very averse to this situation. Mike Wazowski and James Sullivan in Monsters Incorporated have been told that human children are literally toxic.
Right.
And then in Ice Age, of course, you have these three animals, a woolly mammoth, a saber tooth, and a sloth, who wind wind up taking care of this human baby and trying to return him to his nomadic herd. And of course, this is their mortal enemy. So there's subtextually what you have here is what you might call a theme of antinatalist anxieties.
Right.
Babies are bad. Babies are scary. Parental responsibility is scary. And since the protagonists are all male, fatherhood is scary. Right. But what do they discover by the end? Things are very different than what they thought, and their hearts are opened, and they realize that what they had thought about babies is not really the case.
Right. And so you get this whole, with all these stories, fatherhood becomes a mode of redemption for each one of these characters. They become characters who grow beyond themselves and become, and of course you find that, for example, in Monsters, Inc., the whole paradigm of Monsters, Inc. is the reason you need the monsters have to go to the human world at all, which they believe is dangerous for them, is because that's where they get they derive their whole power grid from, screams of children. So that's the mission, is to go frighten children, and that somehow magically provides power for the monster universe. And everything is focused on, we have to harvest all these screams. Everything has to be about fear. Fear is the only thing that can save you, generating more and more fear. And then suddenly, to their surprise, what they discover is that laughter and joy, have like infinitely, vastly more power. Our whole universe was predicated on fear as our salvation. And then what we discover is that actually joy is our salvation. And that, of course, that's in itself is a profoundly Christian message. Jesus, much of the Sermon on the Mount is simply predicated on telling people, stop being enslaved to your fear. Who of you by worrying can add one cubit to his height? And these amazing simplifications that Jesus offers us, that if God so clothes the grass of the field today, how will he not also clothe you? Don't worry about this stuff. The Gentiles worry about this stuff. But your heavenly Father knows what you need before you ask him. And so this, what sounds like just sort of buttercup twirling, fantasy, in the words of Jesus, is he's saying God loves you. You don't have to live by fear. That's a remarkably neglected pro-life message as well. So anyway, I just thought I would hold forth on that for a minute. It looks like we're running close to out of time.
It's been a great hour, as always.
As always, yes.
And I highly recommend that listeners get to the theater this weekend and see The Young Messiah and tell me if you think that I'm right, that it's better than Risen and that it's really worth seeing. And if I'm wrong, then tell me that too. And you can read my piece on The Young Messiah, on the human knowledge of Christ, and on animation and the cultures of life and death at Decent Films.
It's decentfilms.com. Check it out. And by the way, just go look at the website for all the other stuff, because Steve has piled up quite a backlog of very impressive work at decentfilms.com over the last few years.
Thanks,
Mark. you can check it all out there. Well, you're very welcome. We will be back on Monday with Simca Fisher. You've been listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. My co-host today was Steve Gradonis. Our producer was Ethan Boland. And we will be back on Monday. Until then, toodaloo.
Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.